We'll now invite Brother Greg forward to speak to his subject, Hope for a Hopeless World.
Thanks, Pete. I think what's more hopeless is me ever getting a presentation done properly. So that will power this up again and hope for the best in a sec. So if you just give me a moment. So it goes into sleep mode when it's not hit occasionally, so. There. We made it. Yay. And I apologize, I'm going to have to start up right from scratch again, too, of course. Catch a short nap while you're waiting, I think, so. Oh, dear. Okay. Give this a try. Finally. Apologies for that. I'm still going to have to do some fiddling through it, but we'll give this a try tonight. Sorry, we had it all worked out, completely organized, but unfortunately, events and technology. So this is obviously going to be a Bible-based lecture. That's the point of it. And we're going to do something a little different. I mean, the theme for tonight is hope for a hopeless world. There's lots of things to feel hopeless about in the world. But we're going to have a kind of a laser focus on one particular aspect because a lot of things depend on this particular issue, and so I want to spend a bit of time just going over it, just so you have an idea as to how important this really is. I don't think many people really understand this particular issue and how important it is for us and the consequences of what's happening in the world today. There's lots of things to worry about, as we said. There's the U.S. election. That seems to be on everybody's mind. There's Brexit. There's ISIS. There's hunger, poverty, and all the other things that seem to be plaguing us in this day and age. And yet there's one particular problem that has got a greater impact than all of them, I think. When I was doing some research, I looked to some of the data that's coming out of an organization in Geneva, Switzerland, called the World Economic Forum. And they're recognized as an international institute, as a public-private organization, because they are an organization whose mission is cited to as committed to improving the state of the world by engaging business, politics, academia, and other leaders of society to shape global, regional, an industrial agenda. So they're kind of like a think tank that's designed to research world problems, essentially. And over the past few years, this group, the World Economic Forum, has published a document they call the Global Risks Report, which has been, they've been doing this now for several years. And the report is their assessment of the most present and serious problems for that particular year and then projected into the future. And so their real concern is global stability. And this year, the World Economic Forum published its risks report for 2016, earlier this year. And the report looked at 29 factors overall. However, they then further break them down into the top 10 and then into the top 5. And it's really interesting what they found when they did an analysis. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read all of this. This is the top 10 risks that are facing the globe overall. And they include things like, they can include things like large-scale involuntary migration, like we're seeing in Syria, extreme weather events, like we saw in West Virginia this last week. This is just not my night for technology. The failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation, interstate conflict, natural catastrophes, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes down in degree, I guess, as you're going through it. And so those are the top 10, and they list the impact of what these things will, what will happen if these things come to pass, essentially. The five greatest risks that they see are really important, I think, because this year was different from every other year in the past. They saw large-scale involuntary migration, extreme weather events, failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation, interstate conflict with regional consequences, and major natural catastrophes is the five top things that they worry about. Now, they're not looking at this from the perspective of biblical-based believers. They're looking at this as the risk that they see in the world today for all mankind, no matter where you live. And in the report itself, I'm just going to read a little tiny section of it, but in the report it says that such a broad risk landscape is unprecedented in the 11 years the report has been measuring global risks. For the first time, 4 out of 5 categories, environmental, geopolitical, societal, and economic, feature among the top 5 most impactful risks. The only category not to feature is technical risk, where the highest ranking risk is cyber attack, in 11th position in both likelihood and impact. And I'm going to try and play a video. It won't play from here. But I'm going to do it anyways, even though I know this is fraught with craziness to even try and do it. But we'll see how it works out.
The fourth industrial revolution will bring a level of change humanity has never experienced before. We still don't know to what extent it will affect countries, economies, and people. The Global Risks Report 2016 analyzes the potential impact and likelihood of 29 global risks over the next 10 years. For the first time ever, environmental, geopolitical, societal, and economic all feature among the top 5 most impactful risks. In terms of impact, the top risk is failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation. It is considered to have greater potential damage than weapons of mass destruction, water crisis, large-scale involuntary migration, and severe energy price shock. The likelihood of most risks has grown this year, increasing the magnitude of global challenges for the next decade. Large-scale involuntary migration rose to number 1, followed by extreme weather events, failure of climate change mitigation and adaptation, interstate conflict with regional consequences, and major natural catastrophes. Global risks are interconnected, and that can create unexpected consequences. Profound social instability and unemployment or underemployment feature as the two most interconnected risks this year. The report also explores a nexus of risks that have the most potential to threaten global stability. The disempowered citizen looks at how citizens who are empowered by technology also feel disconnected from existing governance structures. The impact of climate change, which together with rising population growth can affect global food security, and the potential of global pandemics to threaten social cohesion. Adaptation and resilience will be crucial to address the upcoming global challenges. Join the conversation to ensure that today's risks don't become tomorrow's realities.
I'll leave that there. So these are the risks that they see, that this secular organization sees as the greatest risks in the world today. And the report is important because there's a big change in the nature of the report from what they had before over the last 11 years and this year. It sees the major risk facing the globe today and all mankind and all life on the globe as global warming and climate change, period. There is no other risk that they see as bigger than that. And that's alarming, to say the least, because climate change is happening, whether we choose to believe it or not. I mean, there's still a few people who don't believe that it's happening, but they can say that it doesn't, but it doesn't matter. It's happening whether we say it isn't or it is. And it's not so much the fact that it is happening, because we know it is. It's the failure to do anything about it, which is the real critical problem, or doing too little too late, that is really identified as the biggest risk, the mitigation of climate change and global warming. Of course, lots of people think this is propaganda, but there's so much data now, and I'll show you one other thing if I get it working, to actually show you how real this is. We think that it might not be real, but it is. So the other thing I thought was very interesting is coming from here. In the U.S., the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, earlier this year released a document as well, late last year and early this year. And in a statement, they identified climate change as the greatest security risk to the United States. Now, that's not something I don't think we would be used to hearing. We'd think ISIS or terrorism or things like that would be the greatest risk on the planet, according to the Department of Defense in the United States. But they say that global climate change will aggravate problems such as poverty, social tensions, environmental degradation, ineffectual leadership, weak political institutions that threaten stability in a number of countries. The Senate Appropriations Committee requested the report in conjunction with the Defense Appropriations Act for 2015, asking that the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy provide a report that identifies the most serious and likely climate-related security risks for each combatant, command, etc., etc. The report finds that climate change is a security risk. The Pentagon official said because it degrades living conditions, human security, and the ability of governments to meet the basic needs of their populations, it is their number one risk right now. Communities and states that already are fragile and have limited resources and are significantly more vulnerable to disruption and far less likely to respond effectively and be resilient to new challenges. The Department of Defense, their primary responsibility is to protect national security interests in the U.S., of course, and around the world. An official said in a news release announcing the report's submission, "This involves considering all aspects of the global security environment and planning appropriately for potential contingencies and so forth." And they said, "It is in this context that the department must consider the effects of climate change, such as sea level rise, shifting climate zones, and more frequent and intense severe weather events, and how those events could impact national security." Now, I read that at length. It is a long statement. The report itself is very interesting, just to show how important it is. If we think of how governments work normally, they're not alarmists generally by nature. But this is becoming so critical. They see the situation so critical, and the consequences so critical, now they're seeing it as a major security risk. So I think what came out of the report, the bulk of it that I read, was it's not just climate change that they're worried about, but the lack of commitment on the part of governments and large multinational corporations to be proactive and do things in time to mitigate the risk. So their thinking is, is they don't believe that things are going to happen soon enough to make a difference anymore. It's too late to make any big changes. With temperatures rising in the tropics and across the globe, the Department of Defense predicts a migration of people from south to north to cooler climates. This could mean more people leaving places like Central America and Mexico. It could also mean when temperatures in places like Arizona, Southern California, and places like that become absolutely unbearable, that large-scale migration is inevitable. People will want to move to cooler climates, and they will have no place to go but move north or south, depending upon which hemisphere they're in, whether in the north or the south hemisphere. They'll have no choice but to migrate to other places. Now, we'll see if we can actually get this to work, but I'm going to put something else up just out of interest's sake, if it actually does work. Here it is. Come on, little guy. I'll let you look at this for a second, and I won't try and explain it too much. Just to show that this is the average monthly temperature that's been taken since 1860 till 2016. And you'll see as this spiral goes out and out, you'll see that the last 20 or 30 years is dramatic. It's exploding out almost. And it doesn't seem like a degree or a degree and a half Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius is a big deal, but it is an immensely big deal because we're already seeing crazy temperatures these days. In Phoenix last week, the temperature was over 50 degrees Celsius. In India, a few weeks ago, the temperature reached 51 and 52 degrees Celsius. I mean, previously, those temperatures were only ever seen in places like Death Valley and California and things like that. But temperatures are on the rise. They're the highest temperatures ever recorded since they've been recording temperatures. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration in the U.S. recently stated, the combined average temperature over global land and ocean surfaces for March 2016 was the highest for this month since they've been recording temperatures since 1880. At 1.22 degrees Celsius, above the 20th century average of 12.7 degrees, it surpassed the previous record set in 2015 by almost a half a degree. And that doesn't seem like very much, but it's a huge impact on the planet. It marks the highest monthly temperature departure among all the 1,635 months on record, surpassing the previous all-time record set just last month. Overall, the 9 highest monthly temperature departures in this record have all occurred in the last 9 months. So in the last 9 months, those are the maximum temperatures they've ever recorded since the 1880s. March 2016 also marks the 11th consecutive month a monthly global temperature record has been broken, the longest streak in their 137-year history. I've got another little video, which I hope to show you, if I can get this little guy to go off of here. Sorry to plague you with all these little videos, but they're kind of interesting.
Climate change is already impacting every continent and ocean on the planet. Hundreds of scientists and experts came to this conclusion in a new report for the United Nations. The report has taken 5 years to make and is part of the definitive study on climate change to date. Here's some of the report's biggest findings when it comes to climate change's impact, summarized on this map. In the report, scientists use a scale to explain how confident they are about a given impact and whether it's caused by climate change, even when other factors like pollution play a role. For now, let's focus on impacts that scientists are very confident can be linked to climate change. And undisputed facts will be indicated like this. So let's start with the oceans, which have been getting warmer since 1970. Scientists are highly confident warming has been caused by greenhouse gases that humans have been pumping into the atmosphere. The warming has massive consequences.
One example, in the Northeast Atlantic, fish, zooplankton, seabirds, and other species are moving towards the poles to escape the heat. And in the Mediterranean, some species have died en masse, while new warm water species have invaded. How does this affect people? Well, 90% of the people who work in fisheries come from the world's poorer countries and won't have jobs if fish move or disappear. No fish also means no food, especially for places like Central and Western Africa, Peru, Colombia, and elsewhere, which rely on the sea for food security. And it's not just sea life that's affected. Animals and plants in Europe, North America, Chile, and Malaysia have recently moved an average of 17 kilometers towards the poles and 11 meters up in altitude to escape the heat. But moving isn't an option for coral reefs. Coral reefs around the world are bleaching and dying in increasing numbers. Coral reefs are home to more than 4,000 species of fish. The irreversible loss of reefs would impact 500 million people who rely on reef ecosystems for $5 billion a year. Finally, there's the Arctic. So many changes are happening in the Arctic that scientists say a regime shift is taking place there. The Arctic's permafrost is thawing and shrubs are literally creeping upwards into areas where they couldn't grow before. Animals that rely on ice like polar bears and seals are being severely affected, especially in the warming summers. In turn, food security for the indigenous people who live in the Arctic is threatened. And that's just the tip of the iceberg as glaciers continue to melt worldwide because of climate change, raising sea levels. Pretty scary stuff, huh? So, is climate change already impacting you where you live? Let us know by commenting on this video, and don't forget to subscribe to Agent Plus.
Another not-so-happy video. It's a great little animation, actually, but not very pleasant when you think about it. The UN is spending a lot of time and energy addressing this problem with symposiums, conferences, analysis, technical papers. The question on many people's mind now, which is what's coming up, is can we stop global warming from happening? That's the question now. Or can it be mitigated? And the answer from scientists who are supposed to know these things is it probably can't be stopped now. It would take a monumental effort on our part. What would have to happen is we would have to stop driving our cars, turn off all our factories, stop farming the way we're doing almost immediately in order to even mitigate what's happening. These are serious problems when you think about it. And when you look at what's actually being done, though, what's actually being done by governments, by corporations, and by citizens, it's very inconsequential, really. Even if you consider some of the agreed-upon standards, it still wouldn't prevent what's happening from happening in the future. And for those of us who are a little older, I mean, that's one thing. We can see it happening, and we probably won't see the great impact of it if this continues on. But what will happen to our children and our grandchildren? What kind of a world will they live in if this continues to spiral out of control? You have to consider two future events, one under current conditions, and the second, if we implemented all of the current agreements to reduce environmental change. It might make a difference, but it would be too small to alter the trajectory. That's the thinking of scientists like David Suzuki and others, that the existing agreements have come far too little, far too late. Now, all of that seems extremely depressing. It is just extremely depressing when you think about it. These dynamics, and which is what worries the Department of Defense, these dynamics don't exist just in the continental United States or Canada or Europe or South America. They exist across the globe, and they cross boundaries and divisions of countries, which is where the real problem starts to come into over the near future. All of this is depressing, but when you add all of the other things that are afflicting mankind, like terrorism and unstable nations and global economics and things like Britain leaving the UK and stuff like that, people are starting to get worried now. actually starting to get worried and concerned about these things. And they're wondering where hope is going to come from, really. Although the solution to many of these problems is known and understood, very little is actually being done to change it. Not many people are taking it seriously enough. Perhaps it's greed or capitalism or selfishness that's preventing countries or multinational corporations. But whatever it is, the response is too little, too late. No wonder people feel pessimistic and hopeless these days, especially now if you live in West Virginia or Arizona or Southern California or a host of other places, India, South America, those sorts of places. It's out of their control to do anything. Now, I'm going to digress a little bit because I think it has pertinence to this. When I was growing up, I wasn't raised in a very religious home, unfortunately. I came to that when I was in my mid-20s. When I was young, I used to be a very big fan of science fiction. I just consumed science fiction voraciously. I read all kinds of books. Some of these you may heard of or may not have heard of, books like Fahrenheit 541, 1984, Logan's Run, Brave New World, War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, those sorts of things. Those were the things I read when I was young. And unlike fantasy novels, like Lord of the Rings, that kind of thing, science fiction is different. It explores the potential consequences of scientific and other innovations, as we call the literature of ideals. Now, I mention this because I think it relates sometimes to why we are so slow in addressing some of the problems. For example, a novel I read when I was young called Logan's Run was published in 1967, and it depicts a dystopic future society, a dystopian society, in which both the population and the consumption of resources is maintained in equilibrium because of the environment and all kinds of things. In any case, anyone reaching the age of 29, when you reach the age of 30, you were put to death, essentially. This is one particular view of the future, one fictional view of the future. And the people who were charged with enforcing this rule would track down people who tried to run and put them to death, because that's the length of time you were allowed to live, until 30. That's it. And they made a movie of it, and so forth and so on. It's interesting from a point of view because science fiction explores potential futures. What could possibly happen? Because it's based on science, essentially. Whether it's past or current realities. And I think there's a really close tie-in to science fiction as opposed to fantasy or other types of fiction because it closely ties in with humanism. Because even though people despair at the state of the world and the scope of the problems we have, it's interesting that more and more people are now moving away from God, not closer to God. They see all these things happening, and you would think, or your hope would be, that you'd be engaged in more conversations with people about God, about the hope that we share from a biblical point of view. But in fact, people are moving away and drawing closer to things like ancient Gnosticism and humanism, essentially. At least that's the trend I am seeing with the people that I know of. It's more of a secular, humanistic society where pretty much anything goes as long as you're not hurting anybody else. Humanism, to quote from the American Humanist Association, is a progressive philosophy of life that without supernaturalism affirms our ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of humanity. It relates to humans, humans helping humans. The life stance of humanism, guided by reason, inspired by compassion, and informed by experience, encourages us to live life well and fully. It evolved through the ages and continues to develop through the efforts of thoughtful people who recognize that values and ideals, however carefully wrought, are subject to change as our knowledge and understanding advance. So there's the mission of the American Humanist Association. The mission is to advance humanism, an ethical and life-affirming philosophy free of belief in any gods and other supernatural forces, advocating for equality for non-theists and a society guided by reason, empathy, and our growing knowledge of the world. The AHA promotes a worldview that encourages individuals to live informed and meaningful lives that aspire to the greater good. And without dealing a lot with what humanism is and what it's all about, their take on global problems is, as if you read their literature on their site, their take on how we're going to solve all of these problems, whether it's ISIS or terrorism, or whether it's global warming, or whether it's economic collapse, or all these sorts of things, is for social action and applying science to solve these problems. Interestingly, humanism has been around for quite a long time, and these principles have yet to be seen in practical application. As such, kind of interestingly, I thought, when I reflected upon it, that a lot of humanists and scientists also tend to write a lot of science fiction. Not all of them, but most of them tend to do that. And if you adhere to this kind of thinking, where humanists believe that social responsibility or social action and science can solve all of our problems, you would think that most science fiction would give us these beautiful visions of the future where we've solved all of our problems and things are now good and we live in harmony, absolute harmony, because social action and science will solve all of those problems. Now, it's interesting, I work in a technology department and I work with a bunch of geeks, and I had a discussion with the other day, and I sit around the lunch table. You guys all read this stuff and you've been living this stuff for most of your lives. I would be very interested if you could name me one book you've ever read in science fiction that ever showed a positive or hopeful future. I said, go away, think about it, come back. Tell me, if you have ever read any book that has a hopeful future, something that where we've solved all of our problems and things are rosy and we're living idyllic lives. And interestingly enough, after I asked them and they couldn't think of anything, when I went back and did a bit of research, I found one book that had some potential for a hopeful existence. Only after nuclear war and, you know, major chaos and that sort of thing. The response is that people can't remember any of these books, any of this thinking. A dystopia, which is what the future looks like to most writers of science fiction, is an unpleasant society, a repressive society usually, often propagandized as being utopian, like Logan's Run, for instance, or 1984, or some of these other science fiction books. I've only found one book out of the hundreds, thousands that are out there that show the picture of the future as an idyllic life, as a utopia, not a dystopian future. I think that's interesting. Maybe it's partly because chaos is a lot more interesting to write than about a hopeful future. But to the humanist, it seems easy to assume that somehow, and it's rarely declared, but everything's going to turn out all right. Mankind's going to finally get together. We're going to solve global warming and climate change and all of these social problems we have. Somehow that's going to happen. Countries are going to start to work together rather than at odds with each other. People are going to stop being selfish and greedy and look to the betterment of each other rather than themselves. And eventually, future generations, I don't know how far in the future, but eventually future generations will have the kind of idyllic life that we and everyone before us would like to see today, but we're not seeing it. It all seems possible to the humanist, or to people who believe that kind of thing. It all seems very possible. And yet when people write about possible futures, none of them are ever or rarely positive. I think that's interesting. That struck me as being fascinating. And I think the reason is because everybody at their heart knows what human nature is really like. Trying to get countries to work together, trying to get multinational corporations that are, their whole structure is based on making a profit, on those sorts of things, is not going to change. Unfortunately, human nature is we tend to be greedy, we tend to be selfish, we hate, we're jealous, we tend to be envious, we can be immoral, we can be hurtful, we can be egotistical, and all the other negative things we know about each other. The Bible provides us, I think, interesting with the answers to these sorts of things. It also teaches us what the future will really look like. If we look at what the Bible says about us, unlike the humanist sort of way of looking at things where people are basically good and we want to live by those sorts of ethics, as they call them, based on their own thinking, God has a different view of what man is like. Jeremiah 17, the heart of mankind is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Ecclesiastes chapter 9. This is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go down to the dead. Now I wonder, as probably everybody else does, how do you see a positive future at any time in the future when men's hearts, if we believe men's hearts, are actually like that? How countries will ever come together and work out the problems that we have, these global issues? If the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked, how is that going to come to pass? How will science ever solve global warming or climate change or all of the things that we deal with? The fact is that it's impossible with these conditions for man to solve these problems. And that's why that little spirally thing that you saw, that sort of data analysis, is continuing to spin out of control, because the will to do something might require that I'm going to have to give something up, or I might have to agree with somebody, or I might have to shut down factories and put people out of work and in order to save the planet, that sort of thing. Those things aren't going to happen, or if they do, they're going to be too little, too late. As long as we feel we can solve our own problems, and as long as we are left to our own devices, essentially, without the influence of God in our lives, we're never going to have any hope for a positive outcome for the future. As long as we don't maintain moral principles instead of just fuzzy ethics that are derived from God and not from our own, man can't solve those problems. For 6,000 years, we believe, man has repeatedly failed to solve these problems. We have wars. They had wars 6,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. We continue to have wars. We still have hunger. We still have poverty. We still have disease. We may have made some minor advances in medicine and things like that, but all of these negative things continue to plague us and aren't really getting any better. In fact, some of the problems we're creating now are far worse than the problems we had 100 years ago or 50 years ago. We believe that without the influence of God in our lives, mankind is continuing to spiral into destruction. And the irony of humanists is, although they hope for a utopian future, when they write about it, all they see is pain and suffering. So there's one source among us which has never misled us concerning false expectations. It's the Bible that we all have in front of us. Throughout the Bible, human history is seen as ending in a great climax, frequently called the time of the end. We don't have time to go into tonight, or the last days, and certain passages tell us quite clearly what these last days will be like. And this is one of them right here. There will be signs in the sun, the moon, and the stars, and there will be distress on earth among the nations that are confused by the roaring of the sea and its waves. People will faint from fear and apprehension because of the things that are come on the inhabited world, because the powers of heaven will be shaken. That's a striking picture of a world in distress, the time of the end. You look at those allusions to the sun, the moon, the stars, the seas and the waves, the powers of heaven. Even if you go to the things that are literal, upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, men's hearts failing them for fear, and for expectations of the things which are coming on the earth. Those things are literal, not figurative. It is fearfully literal. It has to do with nations, men's hearts, with fear, with perplexity because of dreadful events. Remarkably, the second word for earth literally means the inhabited earth. Nothing figurative about that. It's not spiritual. It's a literal earth that these things are going to happen to. Perplexity implies at one's wit's end. There's no escaping the conclusion to be drawn from this part of Jesus' discourse in Luke chapter 21. At a time when the domination of Jerusalem by the nations comes to an end, mankind upon the earth is to experience worldwide distress in the time of the end, in our time, when there's going to be fear and perplexity. People will literally be at their wit's end. And that's what's going to happen to us. If it isn't happening already, it's going to happen to us in the very near future. No matter what man tries to do, it's going to be too little, too late. To stop global warming, scientists believe we have to stop doing everything right now. We have to stop driving our cars, turn off all our factories for the most part, change the way we farm, change the way we live, do all of those things in order to mitigate it. We know, everybody in this room knows, that is not going to happen because people don't want to see their jobs disappear. People don't want to stop driving their cars. It's actually a form of selfishness. We don't want to change our way of life. By the time we finally do, it'll be too late. And yet, I think through all of this, what's really important, at least for me anyways, when I sit and look at this, is if you look at how dismal the world could be if things continue to sort of spiral faster and faster out of control, we have a hope, which is what this lecture is really all about. There's one source which from the beginning has seen human life on earth as creating problems, world problems, global problems that we have. It demands a solution. And if we put our trust in humanists and scientists and our fellow humans, there's no hope at all, I don't think. I think that there is no hope based on what history has taught us and what we see every day. The only hope that we have is from the Bible, that God is actually in control, that he is the creator, and he is going to solve these problems for us. That is the only hope that we have. The time of the end comes, the control of the world will be taken from men, for the kingdom is the Lord's, it says in Psalm 22, he is the ruler over the nations. If somebody doesn't do something and do it really quickly, it will be a big problem. And the only one capable of doing that, we believe, is the Lord Jesus Christ. When he returns to the earth, which we believe will be soon, all kings shall fall down before him, all nations shall serve him, Psalm 21. So the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea, Isaiah 11. The world problems foreseen in the Bible for thousands of years are finally going to receive a world solution for a change. The only way of solving it. How did the Bible writers know up to 2,500 years ago that there would be a time such as this? Even the most, what seems like uninformed men saw what the future would be like. And yet 100 years ago, if you asked people to look at what the future would be like in 100 years ago, they would be hard-pressed to believe where things have gone in 100 years. The only answer that there is that there is a God. We believe there is a God who is in control and who is going to solve these problems, because we know that mankind can't. We have to believe that God can solve these problems. The question we have to ask ourselves is we've been talking about people all over the planet, from whether they're in India or the United States or Canada or Britain or wherever they may be. But this is a question that's personal. It relates to all of us. It's a very personal topic. The Bible's clear and precise about the future of individual men and women as it is about the world. It analyzes our human nature. It points out what is the cause of the evils that afflict humanity, shows how we have to order our lives in the service of God, and reveals to us the future we may have in the future world kingdom to be established by the Lord Jesus Christ. The problems affecting our planet are so important that they cannot be properly emphasized enough. We have to make a choice to either put our trust in mankind and man's ability to solve these problems, or put our trust and confidence in God. That's really what the choice comes down to. Meanwhile, we need to gain comfort from that reflection, that God has always been concerned with the individual man or woman who gives earnest thought to the words he has written down in this book. If you consider this from Isaiah chapter 66, it really helps us to feel some confidence that God is working in our lives and will work in our lives. This is what the Lord says: "Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you would build for me, and where will my resting place be? All these things my hand has made, and so all these things came into being, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look favorably, to the one who is humble and contrite in spirit and who trembles at my message." Those words were written hundreds of years before the Lord Jesus Christ still apply today. God is gracious. He's merciful. He's always wanting to show those who are conscious of their weaknesses and imperfections a better way to live, who approach his word in humble reverence, who look to him for help and guidance, and who put their trust and hope in him. The marvel is that the very words of God are still available to us, even in the sort of chaotic world we have today. And all you have to do is turn on the television to see how crazy it is today and how crazier it's getting year by year. So Jesus said to his disciples, and their words that we can apply to ourselves, "The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life." And we have to put our hope in that God will solve these problems and will deliver us from the sort of chaos that we have today. So, thank you.